Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
They're beautiful. They grow in semi-shade. They've got large, almost tropical-looking leaves on them. The fruit's ready usually in September, October, into early November.
Pawpaws. That's what Chef Daniel Orr is working with in his kitchen today. These green fruits look like they'd be more accustomed to hot, beach-like climates, but they grow wild all over the Midwest. We talked to a local forager today to get some tips for finding what round these parts we call the Indiana banana. Author Andrew Moore talks about how farmers have tried to grow a market for cultivated pawpaws. With Harvest Public Media, some marijuana growers in Colorado are misusing the term organic, what state regulators are trying to do about it, and pick your okra when it's still small and you can eat it raw. We've got a recipe for that. A rundown of top stories from the week with Mark Chilla.
The market for organic foods is continuing its explosive growth. According to new data from federal agriculture officials, Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon has more.
Last year, the country's certified organic farms sold $5.5 billion in organic products. That's a 72% increase in 6 years. The goods that brought in the most cash were organic milk, eggs, chicken, lettuce, and apples. Colorado State University economist Don Thilmany says more consumers are demanding organic options, and grocery stores are responding.
As the concept of organic becomes its own brand name, sort of, we've seen more and more products adopted as a way to differentiate themselves or grab a niche of the consumer market.
The data also show a significant crossover in foods marketed as both organic and locally grown. 80% of all organic products in the U.S. traveled less than 500 miles from the farm to the point of sale. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Another report from Luke Runyon coming up today about what the word organic means when we're talking about growing cannabis. Also this week, one-third of all American children are consuming fast food on any given day, and family income has nothing to do with it. Recent data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention found that across all income levels, fast food intake is pretty consistent. In fact, the lower-income children received less of their daily nutrition from fast food than children above the poverty level. The CDC's study arrives on the heels of a study sponsored by the Trust for America's Health and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, The State of Obesity. Obesity rates exceed 35% in 3 states, 30% in 22 states, and every state in the U.S. has an obesity rate higher than 20%. For their part, fast food manufacturers have been lowering calorie counts. On average, new fast food menu items are 60 calories less than old menu items, which can make a dent in children's caloric intake. The Florida Agriculture Department has put an 85-square-mile swath of farmland on lockdown after discovering 159 oriental fruit flies since August 26th. No crops are allowed out of the area unless they are irradiated. The quarantine was imposed just before harvest of many tropical fruits and won't lift until January, even if no more of the flies are found. The pest, known as Bactrocera dorsalis, is known to feed or lay eggs in up to 400 kinds of fruit crops. In each area where a fly was found, workers are spraying pesticides, culling fruit, and setting traps. And Coca-Cola owes an additional $3.3 billion plus interest in unpaid taxes from 2007 to 2009, so said the Internal Revenue Service after a 5-year audit. The soft drink giant plans to contest the discrepancy, which stems from how the company reports income from foreign licenses in overseas markets. The IRS has been cracking down on what it calls abuse of so-called transfer pricing, where companies shift profits from high-tax countries to low-tax countries to cut down on their bills. The agency says Coke failed to report income from its overseas licenses for manufacturing, distribution, sales, marketing, and promotion of its products. Coke said in the SEC filing that it was following rules outlined in a 1996 agreement. A shout out to our news bloggers Liz Leslie and Chad Bouchard for these stories. Follow their posts at eartheats.org.
And Twitter, too. News and recipes and conversations. We're at Earth Eats. This guy is at M. Chilla. Thanks for the news, Mark.
You got it.
Earlier this year, officials in Colorado cited a handful of commercial marijuana growers for misusing pesticides in indoor grow houses. Some of those businesses were also advertising their products as chemical-free and organic. Because the drug is still illegal at the federal level, growers in states where the plant is legal can make all kinds of unchecked claims about their plants. For now, Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon has more.
Nilvio Aquino weaves through an indoor marijuana jungle. He's the lead grower for Sticky Butts, a chain of marijuana shops in Denver.
Throw your nose in there. You know, it's nice and pungent.
And pungent it is. The smell is pervasive. Aquino is clearly in his element among the 7-foot-tall plants. He's like a proud gardener showing off blue ribbon varieties, bustling from plant to plant, picking out his favorites.
I'm all about quality. I'm back and forth with owners about yield, of course, but that's life.
Aquino's plants soak up nutrients you'd find on a lot of certified organic farms, like kelp meal and earthworm castings. And when a pest problem pops up, he avoids using synthetic pesticides.
And it's just about, you know, finding your little foothold in the market and holding on to it with, you know, your life, essentially, man.
All that adds up to something that feels like an organic operation. But for now, that's about as official as it's going to get. Unlike almost every other crop in the U.S., there's no such thing as a government-sanctioned certification for organic marijuana. And until recently, growers throughout the state had free rein to use whatever pesticides they wanted in the growing process. Eric Egan is Sticky Bud's general manager.
The customer started asking, well, wait a minute, what are you putting in our product?
We need some standards in cannabis production.
That's John Paul Maxfield. He's one of the founding members of the Organic Cannabis Association, based in Denver. Marijuana is legal in certain states, but still illegal federally. And Maxfield says some opportunistic growers are taking advantage of the conflicts in law and the lag in regulation.
People can grow in ways that aren't organic and receive a premium that should be going to the people that are doing it, what we call right.
The Organic Cannabis Association has started certifying operations as pesticide-free, but Maxfield says they're nowhere near being able to do a full organic certification.
If we're able to be a placeholder until the USDA comes on board, that's a great thing, and we're a long ways away from that, I think.
In the meantime, Colorado consumer fraud regulators have started paying attention to the possibility of misleading advertising. Roger Hudson is the spokesman for the Attorney General's office. He says it's tough to hold businesses accountable when there's no state or federal standards for organic marijuana.
Is there a legal definition at this point in time? No, there's not. But there is a general idea of what organically grown is, and that's something the Colorado Attorney General is looking at and exploring right now.
Probably the most common confusion about organic is exactly what it does and does not mean.
Don Thilmany is an agricultural economist at Colorado State University. Whether you're talking about food or cannabis, she says few consumers know what the term organic is meant to convey.
If you don't have economically literate consumers who will use a word to indicate whatever they want it to indicate, it's a problem.
Back at the Sticky Buds marijuana facility in Denver, grower Nilvio Aquino says the company's focus on organic methods should pay off as the industry matures. Just like food, he says, there's always going to be a group of consumers willing to pay a higher price for something they see as superior.
Your product speaks. That's it. Some people aren't connoisseurs, but we're trying to target connoisseurs.
And he says it's about finding the right mix of regulation and marketing to assure consumers that when a grower says the marijuana is organic, they're not just blowing smoke. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Find more stories like this one at harvestpublicmedia.org. We're blowing out the second part of the show today for Paw Paws. All Paw Paws, all the time, in about 10 minutes. But I wanted to get this recipe in your hands today. We recorded it with Chef Daniel Orr just a few days ago, and it's a great way to hold on to summertime for just one more meal.
All right, so we have some okra right here today. Really one of my favorite vegetables of summertime. When you pick them, I like to pick them from my garden when they're super small, about an inch long. And then I eat them raw. I eat them, the stem and all. They're really, really tender. They're delicious. They've got a beautiful, almost hibiscus-like flower, and they are a member of the hibiscus family. But generally, what you want to be able to do is to take the tip and break it. If the tip doesn't break off and if it's got strings in it, then it's too old. Today we're going to make an island fonji. So I just added a quart of water to a hot pan, And this is an island dish. It's almost like a polenta. When people hear the word fongi, they think of Italian fongi, which means mushrooms. But in the Caribbean, it's a dish of cornmeal mush with okra. All right. So to that quart of water, we're going to add 4 tablespoons of butter, 2 tablespoons of chopped garlic, and then our 1 cup of cornmeal. And you can use your quick cooking cornmeal, which will cook quickly. And we're going to stir that in. Now, you heard me when I poured that water in. It was nice hot water into a hot pan. So this is going to boil real quick. And as it cooks, it will thicken up nicely. So I'm just going to take a whisk, really make sure that all those clumps are out of there. And you're going to taste it, and you just want that kind of raw cornmeal taste to come out. All right, so it's a very bland flavor now because we just have the butter and the cornmeal and the garlic. So we're going to start adding our seasonings. Salt and pepper, of course, our freshly ground pepper. And this should be kind of an aggressively flavored and seasoned dish because usually they would serve this with goat stew or a goat curry. So it's got to kind of stand up to those flavors. And then we're going to finish it with some grated Parmesan cheese. Okay, that's tasting good. I'm just going to add a little more salt. Now that it's nice and bubbling and it's cooked through, I'm going to take the okra and I've sliced it into 1/4-inch thick pieces. And we don't really need to cook it much after this because we want the okra to retain its integrity and to have kind of a crunch to it. So that is our Caribbean island fongi with okra and grated Parmesan.
Simple, but tasty, and also really beautiful with those little green okra discs floating in it. The photo and the recipe at eartheats.org. Coming up, large commercial pawpaw production hasn't taken off in the U.S.
Now, with that said, there is another model for pawpaws, and one that I think gets a lot of people excited, and that's, you know, it's a poster child for small regional markets.
Andrew Moore has written a book about the Indiana banana, and we'll chat with him after this. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats, back again. I'm Annie Corrigan. The pawpaw. It's green on the outside and custard yellow on the inside. How does it taste? Everyone seems to describe it in the same way, like a cross between a mango and a banana. Andrew Moore says what he's getting at with that description is that a pawpaw kind of tastes tropical, and that's saying something for a food that's native to Midwest America.
It's related to these other tropical fruits like guanabana, cherimoya, soursop, sweetsop, fruits that have this wonderful custard-like texture. You can't grow any other fruits like this in the temperate north and get this kind of culinary experience. There's nothing else that you can grow like it.
Moore is the author of a new book, Pawpaw, In Search of America's Forgotten Fruit. He introduces us to an important pawpaw breeder, Neil Peterson, whose varieties of pawpaws he says are among the best. Think of it like tomatoes. You could probably name a half dozen different varieties of tomatoes off the top of your head. It's the same with pawpaws. Peterson named his after rivers.
Those are your Susquehanna, Shenandoah, Potomac, Wabash. Those are really great pawpaws. And other excellent pawpaws from earlier generations include sunflower. that's a really good one. I had the pleasure of eating a couple of those already this year. They've got a really firm, chewy flesh, which is different than a lot of pawpaws that can be very soft. And then Overlease is one that I actually have growing in my own backyard. Overlease is a large pawpaw, round, which means there's going to be more flesh in it.
In a bit, he'll talk some more about the history of cultivating pawpaws, moving the fruit from the wild into orchards. They're soft, with a short shelf life, so that could be part of why the best place to find them is still in the woods and not in the grocery store.
But there are other fruits like that that Americans have gotten around. You know, raspberries are fragile and too have a short shelf life. The same with figs. You can't pick figs early. You have to wait for them to ripen on the plant. And the same is true with pawpaws. You have to pick them when they're ripe, and you have to get them, you know, either to customers' hands or you have to process them rather quickly. So it's not that it can't be done. It'll be challenging, but it can be done, and we've done it before with other fruits.
Andrew Moore introduces us to a few big names in pawpaws in a bit. If you go out looking for your own pawpaw patch, look up at the leaves. Pawpaw leaves are large, long, and shaped sort of like a football. The fruit grows in clumps, and it might be hard to spot against the green leaves. You should probably bring a knife and a spoon with you so you can enjoy some pawpaws in the raw. That's what I imagine Bobby Booz of Sundry Farm doing when she's out foraging.
A part of it is that it's so fun just to take a walk in the woods. For a change, you know, it's sort of always in the field, but you go out there and, you know, so the process of harvesting them is really fun. But then the flavor is so good, and they're so, you know, it's just the experience is kind of unique, so it's a good thing to do. They ripen, yeah, once they ripen, the animals love them. So if they fall, they're gone, you know, they're somebody else's dinner. So we walk out and we shake the trees. And that way, the ones that are, you know, close enough to ripen off the tree will come down.
Where, oh, where is dear little Susie? Where, oh, where is dear little Susie? Where, oh, where is dear little Susie? Way down yonder in the pawpaw patch. Picking up pawpaws, put them in your pocket.
There's an old song my grandma and grandpa used to sing to me about way down yonder in the pawpaw patch. They used to love eating these. When back in that time, they didn't really have all the candies and things that we have now, and they lived out in the country. And so when these ripened up, they would eat these until they got sick. They were so excited. They would find a tree on the way home from school when they walked home, and they would eat the pawpaws until they turned green.
Daniel Orr, again with us in his kitchen. Farmers like Bobby Booz might have some pawpaws on their market tables this week. Buy a bunch and then make this recipe.
They can be all different sizes. They can be quite small to, you know, this is about the largest one you'll find, which is like a medium-sized potato.
Tell me where you got these.
These are grown by a local fellow that brought them into the restaurant yesterday. But you can find them growing wild. The wild ones are generally a lot smaller. And as you can see, these are really nice, big, and fleshy. They're beautiful. They grow in semi-shade. They've got large, almost tropical-looking leaves on them. The fruit's ready usually in September, October, into early November. But basically, you're going to scoop out the flesh of the pawpaw, just like you would kind of taking the kiwi out of the kiwi skin. And then you're going to pass it through a food mill to get out those seeds. And then you have a pawpaw puree. And that you can freeze, or you can use it right away. All right, so we're going to take a half cup of raisins. I've got a cup of water, a half cup of raisins, and a half cup of chopped dates. And I'm going to bring that to a boil and let those moisten up and kind of soak up that water. Okay, and to this we're going to add the rest of the ingredients. A half cup of butter.
Not messing around.
Well, you'll see, this makes a lot of cookies. Okay, and we're going to let that melt. A cup of oatmeal. So see, that's healthy. Quarter teaspoon of salt, a quarter teaspoon of baking soda, and 3/4 teaspoon of baking powder. So they're going to get a little fluffy. Quarter teaspoon of Chinese 5-spice powder, and a cup of flour. Okay. And we're going to add 3/4 cups of pawpaw puree. Okay, and you can kind of see this is all coming together. The oatmeal is starting to absorb some of that liquid. Okay, and then we're going to add 2 eggs and 1/2 cup of walnuts. And I like to toast my walnuts a little bit before I use them in any kind of recipe because it extracts some of the moisture and intensifies the flavor. Okay, then we're going to spoon this dough onto a cookie sheet and bake them at 350 for about 10 minutes.
And you got cookies. EarthEats.org to follow the recipe and see a goofy picture of our man Daniel. Always a good time with him in the kitchen.
Well, I like to eat it fresh. I like to cut it open and eat it with a spoon, whether it's for a dessert or a breakfast.
Author Andrew Moore.
And if I'm going to do, prepare a dish with it, I like to make a pawpaw ice cream. In fact, I bought an ice cream maker when I got into pawpaws because I needed to have that for the recipes.
His book is Pawpaw, In Search of America's Forgotten Fruit. I've been calling them Indiana bananas throughout the show today. But Moore says us Hoosiers don't have sole ownership over the fruit. It's really insert your state here banana. He's heard pawpaws called West Virginia banana, Michigan bananas, Ozark bananas. His book also explores pawpaw culture down south into North Carolina and Illinois. We suspect pawpaws have been growing in this area for 56 million years. That's thanks to fossilized fruits found from New Jersey all the way to Mississippi. We started talking about domesticating pawpaws after the Civil War. In 1888, the American Horticulture Society, headquartered in Greencastle, Indiana, called the pawpaw the most promising native fruit for commercial development. It's fitting, then, that a Hoosier stepped up first.
James A. Little was one of the earliest champions, or at least one of the earliest champions to write about pawpaws. In 1905, he published his 22-page treatise on pawpaws. And it was, his experiences with pawpaws, growing them, picking them in his youth with his father. And he gave a blueprint for what should be done with pawpaws. He wanted folks to set pawpaws out in orchards, grow them from seed, observe the fruit, and find the better ones. And he predicted that that would be done because a lot of the wild pawpaw patches that folks had previously had access to were being converted to agricultural lands. And so he predicted that this would be done. This was in 1905. And it didn't happen, not at least for another 75 years or so.
Little had good reason to be optimistic. Around 1916, pawpaws and blueberries occupied the same place in America's food culture. They're wild foods that scientists wanted to figure out how to grow commercially. Long story short, blueberries won, pawpaws lost. Fast forward to the next pawpaw champion.
Yeah, Neil Peterson is, in the book I call him Johnny Pawpaw Seed. It's a nickname he might be tiring of at this point, but nonetheless, it's a good one. He learned about pawpaws as an edible fruit around 1975, and it became a life quest for him to work with this fruit. He started breeding experiments and collected and tracked down lost cultivars. The pawpaw collectors from that earlier generation, he tracked down those pawpaw collections, planted them in an experimental orchard, and looked for the best pawpaws. And he really did, so much to bring the pawpaw to where it is now. Folks like myself, we may not have heard about pawpaws had it not been for the work that he and, some others have done.
But in the beginning of Peterson's work, it was a lot of sitting around and waiting.
In terms of cultivated fruit, you can start planting trees, but it takes 8 years to see the results if you're growing them from seed. And then if you're doing careful evaluation, you then have to, make a selection. So, for example, Neil Peterson, who was doing the important breeding work, he started planting his trees, I think it was in the early 90s, and he selected about 10 trees out of 1,000, and then he had to grow them out again. He grafted those trees onto the stumps of the first round of pawpaws, and then he had to wait another, 6 years to evaluate the fruit again. So in terms of commercial cultivation, all of this takes time.
There was a picture in the book that I'm hoping you can describe for our radio listeners. It showed a wild pawpaw against a couple cultivated pawpaws. Can you describe the difference?
Yeah, it's the difference between a large apple and a tiny crab apple. One was the size of a peanut, that's the wild fruit, and the other was the size of a small coconut.
Are we worried about losing some of the awesome flavors of pawpaws as we get bigger and more commercially viable?
Yeah, that's a good question and a good concern, but that's not yet something we have to worry about with pawpaws. When we talk about cultivated pawpaws, it's not the same as a tomato or corn that's had centuries of breeding and then from there even gone into the laboratory. When we talk about cultivated pawpaws, often it's just a fruit that someone found in the wild that they decided was really good, that they named, that they took cuttings of and propagated and have since traded and entered into, the nursery trade. So these cultivated fruits, these are sometimes two steps removed from the wild and sometimes not at all. They're just really good pawpaws that the early fruit explorers took the time to know and propagate and that since then we have, the pawpaw community has recognized as really good pawpaws. Even the work of some of the, amateur and professional pawpaw breeders, folks like Jerry Lehman, another Indianan, these bred pawpaws are often just two wild pawpaws crossed, a large pawpaw crossed with a good-tasting pawpaw. So as far as losing, the good flavors and the unique flavors, because there is a wide diversity of pawpaw flavors, that's not really something we have to worry about yet. We're so far from that point.
Pawpaw cultivation is still moving slowly, but it is moving forward. There's excitement around the fruit today. He hints at the end of his book that James A. Little's prediction could come true.
There are pawpaw orchards everywhere from Indiana to Maryland. You're seeing people setting them out by the dozens, the hundreds, and even in a few cases, there's orchards of 1,000 pawpaw trees. So it is happening. We talked just a few minutes ago about the strong personal connection that people have to pawpaws. So we know they're cherished, but whether the fruit will transition into an agricultural product is to be seen. Now, with that said, there is another model for pawpaws and one that I think gets a lot of people excited, and that's, it's a poster child for small regional markets. It doesn't ship very well. So this is something that if a farmer has a few trees or many trees, they can make sales on pawpaws at local farmers markets, and as well as cooperations with other producers like breweries or bakeries or creameries.
But then again, what if the pawpaw bubble bursts? He says no matter what happens, we'll still be able to enjoy a good old-fashioned walk in the wild pawpaw patch. Andrew Moore is the author of Pawpaw in Search of America's Forgotten Fruit. Thanks to him for talking to Earth Eats this week. Do visit our website to find even more pawpaw recipes, eartheats.org. Got persimmons, another wild fall food. That's our focus next week. So be sure to connect with the Earth Eats podcast on iTunes so you don't miss that. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Wonderful to have your company today. Thanks for a good one. I'm Annie Corrigan.